Chapter 13. The Collectivist Wages System. Part 1. In their plans for the reconstruction of society, the collectivists commit, in our opinion, a twofold error. While speaking of abolishing capitalist rule, they intend, nevertheless, to retain two institutions which are the very basis of this rule: representative government and the wages system. As regards so-called representative government, we have often spoken about it. It is absolutely incomprehensible to us that intelligent men, and such are not wanting in the collectivist party, can remain partisans of national or municipal parliaments after all the lessons history has given them, in France, in England, in Germany, or in the United States. While we see parliamentary rule breaking up, and from all sides, criticism of this rule growing louder, not only of its results, but also of its principles, how is it that the revolutionary socialists defend a system already condemned to die? Built up by the middle classes to hold their own against royalty, sanctioning, and at the same time strengthening their sway over the workers, parliamentary rule is preeminently a middle-class rule. The upholders of this system have never seriously maintained that a parliament or a municipal council represent a nation or a city. The most intelligent among them know that this is impossible. The middle classes have simply used the parliamentary system to raise a protecting barrier against the pretensions of royalty without giving the people liberty. But gradually, as the people become conscious of their real interests and the variety of their interests is growing, the system can no longer work. Therefore, democrats of all countries vainly imagine various palliatives. The referendum is tried and found to be a failure. Proportional representation is spoken of, the representation of minorities and other parliamentary utopias. In a word, they strive to find what is not to be found, and after each new experiment they are bound to recognise that it was a failure, so that confidence in representative government vanishes more and more. It is the same with the wages system, because once the abolition of private property is proclaimed and the possession in common of all means of production is introduced, how can the wages system be maintained in any form? This is, nevertheless, what collectivists are doing when they recommend the use of the labour checks as a mode of remuneration for labour accomplished for the great collectivist employer, the state. It is easy to understand why the early English socialists, since the time of Robert Owen, came to the system of labour checks. They simply tried to make capital and labour agree. They repudiated the idea of laying hands on capitalist property by means of revolutionary measures. It is also easy to understand why Proudhon took up later on the same idea. In his mutualist system, he tried to make capital less offensive, notwithstanding the retaining of private property, which he detested from the bottom of his heart, but which he believed to be necessary to guarantee individuals against the state. Neither is it astonishing that certain economists, more or less bourgeois, admit labour checks. They care little whether the worker is paid in labour notes or in coins stamped with the effigy of the Republic or the Empire. They only care to save from destruction the individual ownership of dwelling houses, of land, of factories. In any case, that at least of dwelling houses and the capital that is necessary for manufacturing. And labour notes would just answer the purpose of upholding this private property. As long as labour notes can be exchanged for jewels or carriages, the owner of the house will willingly accept them for rent. And as long as dwelling houses, fields and factories belong to isolated owners, men will have to pay these owners, in one way or another, for being allowed to work in the fields or factories, or for living in the houses. The owners will agree to be paid by the workers in gold, in paper money, or in checks exchangeable for all sorts of commodities. Once that toll upon labour is maintained, and the right to levy it is left with them. But how can we defend labour notes, this new form of wagedom, when we admit that the houses, the fields, and the factories will no longer be private property, that they will belong to the commune or the nation? Part 2. Let us closely examine this system of remuneration for work done, preached by the French, German, and English and Italian collectivists. The Spanish anarchists, who still call themselves collectivists, imply by collectivism the possession in common of all instruments of production, and the liberty of each group to divide the produce as they think fit, according to communist or any other principles. It amounts to this. Everybody works in field, factory, school, hospital, etc. The working day is fixed by the state, which owns the land, the factories, the roads, etc. Every work day is paid for with a labour note, which is inscribed with these words, 8 hours work. With this cheque, the worker can procure all sorts of merchandise in the stores owned by the state or by diverse corporations. The cheque is divisible, so that you can buy an hour's work worth of meat, 10 minutes worth of matches, or half an hour of tobacco. After the collectivist revolution, instead of saying tuppence worth of soap, we shall say 5 minutes worth of soap. Most collectivists, true to the distinction laid down by middle-class economists, and by Marx as well, between qualified work and simple work, tell us moreover that qualified or professional work must be paid a certain quantity more than simple work. Thus, 1 hour's work of a doctor will have to be considered as equivalent to 2 or 3 hours work of a hospital nurse, or to 3 or 5 hours work of a navvy. Professional or qualified work will be a multiple of simple work, says the collectivist Grönlund, because this kind of work needs a more or less long apprenticeship. Some other collectivists, such as the French Marxist Goethe, do not make this distinction. They proclaim the equality of wages. The doctor, the schoolmaster and the professor will be paid in labour checks at the same rate as the navvy. 8 hours visiting the sick in a hospital will be worth the same as 8 hours spent in earthworks or else in mines or factories. Some make a greater concession. They admit that disagreeable or unhealthy work, such as sewerage, could be paid for at a higher rate than agreeable work. 1 hour's work of a sewerman would be worth, say, 2 hours of a professor's work. Let us add that certain collectivists admit of corporations being paid a lump sum for work done. Thus, a corporation would say, here are 100 tons of steel. 100 workmen were required to produce them, and it took them 10 days. Their work day being an 8 hours day, it has taken them 8,000 working hours to produce 100 tons of steel. 8 hours a ton. For this, the state would pay them 8,000 labour notes of 1 hour each, and these 8,000 cheques would be divided among the members of the ironworks as they themselves thought proper. On the other hand, 100 miners having taken 20 days to extract 8,000 tons of coal, coal would be worth 2 hours a ton, and the 16,000 cheques of 1 hour each received by the Guild of Miners would be divided among their members according to their own appreciation. If the miners protested and said that a ton of steel should only cost 6 hours' work instead of 8, if the professor wished to have his day paid 4 times more than the nurse, then the state would interfere and would settle their differences. Such is, in a few words, the organisation the collectivists wish to see arise out of the social revolution. As we see, their principles are collective property of the instruments of production and remuneration to each according to the time spent in producing, while taking into account the productivity of his labour. As to the political system, it would be the parliamentary system, modified by positive instructions given to those elected, and by the referendum, a vote taken by noes or ayes by the nation. Let us own that this system appears to us simply unrealisable. Collectivists begin by proclaiming a revolutionary principle, the abolition of private property, and then they deny it no sooner than proclaimed, by upholding an organisation of production and consumption which originated in private property. They proclaim a revolutionary principle and ignore the consequences that this principle will inevitably bring about. They forget that the very fact of abolishing individual property in the instruments of work, land, factories, road, capital, must launch society into absolutely new channels, must completely overthrow the present system of production, both in its aim as well as in its means, must modify daily relations between individuals as soon as land, machinery, and all other instruments of production are considered common property. They say, no private property, and immediately after strive to maintain private property in its daily manifestations. You shall be a commune as far as regards production, fields, tools, machinery, all that has been invented up till now. Factories, railways, harbours, mines, etc., all are yours. Not the slightest distinction will be made concerning the share of each in this collective property. But from tomorrow, You will minutely debate the share you are going to take in the creation of new machinery, in the digging of new mines. You will carefully weigh what part of the new produce belongs to you. You will count your minutes of work, and you will take care that a minute of your neighbour's should not buy more than yours. And as an hour measures nothing, as in some factories a worker can see to 6 power looms at a time, while in another he only tends 2, you will weigh the muscular force, the brain energy, and the nervous energy you have expended. You will accurately calculate the years of apprenticeship in order to appraise the amount each will contribute to future production. And this, after having declared that you do not take into account his share in past production. Well, for us it is evident that a society cannot be based on 2 absolutely opposed principles, 2 principles that contradict one another continually. And a nation or a commune which would have such an organisation would be compelled to revert to private property in the instruments of production, or to transform itself into a communist society. Part 3. We have said that certain collectivist writers desire that a distinction should be made between qualified or professional work and simple work. They pretend that an hour's work of an engineer, an architect or a doctor must be considered as 2 or 3 hours' work of a blacksmith, a mason or a hospital nurse. And the same distinction must be made between all sorts of trades necessitating apprenticeship and the simple toil of day labourers. Well, to establish this distinction would be to maintain all the inequalities of present society. It would mean fixing a dividing line from the beginning between the workers and those who pretend to govern them. It would mean dividing society into 2 very distinct classes, the aristocracy of knowledge placed above the horny-handed lower orders, the one doomed to serve the other, the one working with its hands to feed and clothe those who, profiting by their leisure, study how to govern their fosterers. It would mean reviving one of the distinct peculiarities of present society and giving it the sanction of the social revolution. It would mean setting up as a principle an abuse already condemned in our ancient, crumbling society. We know the answer we shall get. They will speak of scientific socialism. They will quote bourgeois economists and Marx, too, to prove that a scale of wages has its raison d'être, as the labour force of the engineer will have cost more to society than the labour force of the navvy. In fact, have not economists tried to prove to us that if an engineer is paid 20 times more than a navvy, it is because the necessary outlay to make an engineer is greater than that necessary to make a navvy? And has not Marx asserted that the same distinction is equally logical between 2 branches of manual labour? He could not conclude otherwise, having taken up on his own account Ricardo's theory of value and upheld that goods are exchanged in proportion to the quantity of work socially necessary for their production. But we know what to think of this. We know that if engineers, scientists or doctors are paid 10 or 100 times more than a labourer, and if a weaver earns 3 times more than an agricultural labourer, and 10 times more than a girl in a match factory, it is not by reason of their cost of production, but by reason of a monopoly of education or a monopoly of industry. Engineers, scientists and doctors merely exploit their capital, their diplomas, as middle-class employers exploit a factory, or as nobles used to exploit their titles of nobility. As to the employer who pays an engineer 20 times more than a labourer, it is simply due to personal interest. If the engineer can economise £4,000 a year on the cost of production, the employer pays him £800. And if the employer has a foreman who saves £400 on the work by cleverly sweating workmen, he gladly gives him £80 or £120 a year. He parts with an extra £40 when he expects to gain £400 by it. And this is the essence of the capitalist system. The same differences obtain among different manual trades. Let them, therefore, not talk to us of the cost of production, which raises the cost of skilled labour, and tell us that a student who has gaily spent his youth in a university has a right to a wage 10 times greater than the son of a miner, who has grown pale in a mine since the age of 11. Or that a weaver has a right to a wage 3 or 4 times greater than that of an agricultural labourer. The cost of teaching a weaver his work is not 4 times greater than the cost of teaching a peasant his. The weaver simply benefits by the advantages his industry reaps in international trade, from countries that have as yet no industries, and in consequence of the privileges accorded by all states to industries in preference to the tilling of the soil. Nobody has ever calculated the cost of production of a producer. And if a noble loafer costs far more to society than a worker, it remains to be seen whether a robust day labourer does not cost more to society than a skilled artisan, when we have taken into account infant mortality among the poor, the ravages of anemia and premature deaths. Could they, for example, make us believe that the 1 shilling threepence paid to a Paris workman, the threepence paid to an Auvergne peasant girl who grows blind at lace-making, or the 1 shilling 8pence paid to the peasant represent their cost of production? We know full well that people work for less, but we also know that they do so exclusively because, thanks to our wonderful organisation, they would die of hunger did they not accept these mock wages. For us, the scale of remuneration is a complex result of taxes, of governmental tutelage, of capitalist monopoly. In a word, of state and capital. Therefore, we say that all wages theories have been invented after the event to justify injustices at present existing, and that we need not take them into consideration. Neither will they fail to tell us that the collectivist scale of wages would be an improvement. It would be better, so they say, to see certain artisans receiving a wage 2 or 3 times higher than common labourers, than to see a minister receiving in a day what a workman cannot earn in a year. It would be a great step towards equality. For us, this step would be the reverse of progress. To make a distinction between simple and professional work in a new society would result in the revolution sanctioning and recognising as a principle a brutal fact we submit to nowadays, but that we nevertheless find unjust. It would mean imitating those gentlemen of the French Assembly who proclaimed on August the 4th, 1789, the abolition of feudal rights, but who on August the 8th sanctioned these same rights by imposing dues on the peasants to compensate the noblemen, placing these dues under the protection of the revolution. It would mean imitating the Russian government, which proclaimed at the time of the emancipation of the serfs that certain lands should henceforth belong to the nobility, while formerly these lands were considered as belonging to the serfs. Or else, to take a better-known example, when the Commune of 1871 decided to pay members of the Commune Council 12 shillings and 6pence a day, while the federates and the ramparts received only 1 shilling and 3pence. This decision was hailed as an act of superior democratic equality. In reality, the Commune only ratified the former inequality between functionary and soldier, government and governed. Coming from an opportunist Chamber of Deputies, such a decision would have appeared admirable. But the Commune doomed her own revolutionary principles when she failed to put them into practice. Under our existing social system, when a minister gets paid £4,000 a year while a workman must content himself with £40 or less, when a foreman is paid 2 or 3 times more than a workman, and among workmen there is every gradation from 8 shillings a day down to the peasant girl's threepence, we disapprove of the high salary of the minister, as well as of the difference between the 8 shillings of the workman and the threepence of the poor woman. And we say, down with the privileges of education, as well as with those of birth. We are anarchists precisely because these privileges revolt us. They revolt us already in this authoritarian society. Could we endure them in a society that began by proclaiming equality? This is why some collectivists, understanding the impossibility of maintaining a scale of wages in a society inspired by the breath of the revolution, hasten to proclaim equality of wage. But they meet with new difficulties, and their equality of wages becomes the same unrealizable utopia as the scale of wages of other collectivists. A society, having taken possession of all social wealth, having boldly proclaimed the right of all to this wealth, whatever share they may have taken in producing it, will be compelled to abandon any system of wages, whether in currency or labour notes. Part 4. The collectivists say, to each according to his deeds, or in other terms, according to his share of services rendered to society. They think it expedient to put this principle into practice as soon as the social revolution will have made all instruments of production common property. But we think that if the social revolution had the misfortune of proclaiming such a principle, it would mean its necessary failure. It would mean leaving the social problem, which past centuries have burdened us with, unsolved. Of course, in a society like ours, in which the more a man works, the less he is remunerated, This principle at first sight may appear to be a yearning for justice. But in reality, it is only the perpetuation of injustice. It was by proclaiming this principle that wagedom began, to end in the glaring inequalities and all the abominations of present society. Because from the moment work done began to be appraised in currency, or in any other form of wage, the day it was agreed upon that man would only receive the wage he should be able to secure to himself, the whole history of a state-aided capitalist society was as good as written. It was contained in germ in this principle. Shall we, then, return to our starting point and go through the same evolution again? Our theorists desire it, but fortunately it is impossible. The revolution, we maintain, must be communist. If not, it will be drowned in blood and have to be begun over again. Services rendered to society, be they work in factory or field or mental services, cannot be valued in money. There can be no exact measure of value of what has been wrongly termed exchange value, nor of use value in terms of production. If two individuals work for the community 5 hours a day, year in, year out, at different work which is equally agreeable to them, we may say that on the whole, their labour is approximately equivalent. But we cannot divide their work and say that the result of any particular day, hour or minute of work of the one is worth the result of one day, 1 hour or 1 minute of the other. We may roughly say that the man who during his lifetime has deprived himself of leisure during 10 hours a day has given far more to society than the one who has only deprived himself of leisure during 5 hours a day, or who has not deprived himself at all. But we cannot take what he has done during 2 hours and say that the yield of his 2 hours' work is worth twice as much as the yield of another individual who has worked only 1 hour and remunerate the two in proportion. It would be disregarding all that is complex in industry, in agriculture, in the whole life of present society. It would be ignoring to what extent all individual work is the result of the past and the present labour of society as a whole. It would mean believing ourselves to be living in the Stone Age, whereas we are living in an age of steel. If you enter a modern coal mine, you will see a man in charge of a huge machine that raises and lowers a cage. In his hand, he holds a lever that stops and reverses the course of the machine. He lowers it, and the cage reverses its course in the twinkling of an eye. He sends it upwards or downwards into the depths of the shaft with a giddy swiftness. All attention, he follows with his eyes fixed on an indicator, which shows him, on a small scale, at which point of the shaft the cage is at each second of its progress. And as soon as the indicator has reached a certain level, he suddenly stops the course of the cage, not a yard higher nor lower than the required spot. And no sooner have the colliers unloaded their coal wagonettes and pushed empty ones instead, than he reverses the lever and again sends the cage back into space. During 8 or 10 consecutive hours every day, he must keep the same strain of attention. Should his brain relax for a moment, the cage would inevitably strike against the gear, break its wheels, snap the rope, crush men, and put a stop to all work in the mine. Should he waste 3 seconds at each touch of the lever, the extraction in our modern perfected mines would be reduced from 20 to 50 tons a day. Is it he who is the most necessary man in the mine? Or is it perhaps the boy who signals to him from below to raise the cage? Is it the miner at the bottom of the shaft who risks his life every instant and who will someday be killed by fire damp? Or is it the engineer, who would lose the layer of coal and would cause the miners to dig on rock by a simple mistake in his calculations? Or is it the mine owner, who has put his capital into the mine and who has perhaps, contrary to expert advice, asserted that excellent coal would be found there? All those who are engaged in the mine contribute to the extraction of coal in proportion to their strength, their energy, their knowledge, their intelligence, and their skill. And we may say that all have the right to live, to satisfy their needs and even their whims, when the necessaries of life have been secured for all. But how can we appraise the work of each one of them? And, moreover, is the coal they have extracted entirely their work? Is it not also the work of the men who have built the railway leading to the mine, and the roads that radiate from all the railway stations? Is it not also the work of those who have tilled and sown the fields, extracted iron, cut wood in the forests, built the machines that burn coal, slowly developed the mining industry altogether, and so on? It is utterly impossible to draw a distinction between the work of each of those men. To measure the work by its results leads us to an absurdity. To divide the total work and to measure its fractions by the number of hours spent on the work also leads us to absurdity. One thing remains: to put the needs above the works, and first of all, to recognise the right to live, and later on, the right to well-being for all those who took their share in production. But take any other branch of human activity. Take the manifestations of life as a whole. Which one of us can claim the higher remuneration for his work? Is it the doctor who has found out the illness, or the nurse who has brought about recovery by her hygienic care? Is it the inventor of the first steam engine, or the boy who, one day getting tired of pulling the rope that formerly opened the valve to let steam under the piston, tied the rope to the lever of the machine without suspecting that he had invented the essential mechanical part of all modern machinery, the automatic valve? Is it the inventor of the locomotive, or the workman of Newcastle, who suggested replacing the stones formerly laid under the rails by wooden sleepers, as the stones, for want of elasticity, caused the trains to derail? Is it the engineer on the locomotive, the signalman who stops the trains or lets them pass by, the switchman who transfers a train from one line to another? Again, to whom do we owe the transatlantic cable? Is it to the electrical engineer who obstinately affirmed that the cable would transmit messages while learned men of science declared it to be impossible? Is it to Maury, the learned physical geographer, who advised that thick cables should be set aside for others as thin as a walking cane? Or else to those volunteers, come from nobody knows where, who spent their days and nights on deck minutely examining every yard of the cable and removed the nails that the shareholders of steamship companies stupidly caused to be driven into the non-conducting wrapper of the cable so as to make it unserviceable? And in a wider sphere, the true sphere of life, with its joys, its sufferings, and its accidents, cannot each one of us recall someone who has rendered him so great a service that we should be indignant if its equivalent in coin were mentioned? The service may have been but a word, nothing but a word spoken at the right time. Or else it may have been months and years of devotion, and we are going to appraise these incalculable services in labour notes. The works of each. But human society would not exist for more than two consecutive generations if everyone did not give infinitely more than that for which he is paid in coin, in checks, or in civic rewards. The race would soon become extinct if mothers did not sacrifice their lives to take care of their children, if men did not give continually without demanding an equivalent reward, if men did not give most precisely when they expect no reward. If middle-class society is decaying, if we have got into a blind alley from which we cannot emerge without attacking past institutions with torch and hatchet, it is precisely because we have given too much to counting. It is because we have let ourselves be influenced into giving only to receive. It is because we have aimed at turning society into a commercial company based on debit and credit. After all, the collectivists know this themselves. They vaguely understand that a society could not exist if it carried out the principle of each according to his deeds. They have a notion that necessaries, we do not speak of whims, the needs of the individual do not always correspond to his works. Thus, De Pepe tells us, the principle, the eminently individualist principle, would however be tempered by social intervention for the education of children and young persons, including maintenance and lodging, and by the social organisation for assisting the infirm and the sick, for retreats for aged workers, etc. They understand that a man of 40, father of three children, has other needs than the young man of 20. They know that the woman who suckles her infant and spends sleepless nights at its bedside cannot do as much work as the man who has slept peacefully. They seem to take in that men and women, worn out maybe by dint of overwork for society, may be incapable of doing as much work as those who have spent their time leisurely and pocketed their labour notes in the privileged career of state functionaries. They are eager to temper their principle. They say, society will not fail to maintain and bring up its children, to help both aged and infirm. Without doubt, needs will be the measure of the cost that society will burden itself with to temper the principle of deeds. Charity. Charity. Always Christian charity. Organised by the state this time. They believe in improving the asylums for foundlings, in affecting old age and sick insurances so as to temper their principle. But they cannot yet throw aside the idea of wounding first and healing afterwards. Thus, after having denied communism, after having laughed at their ease at the formula to each according to his needs, these great economists discover that they have forgotten something. The needs of the producers, which they now admit, only it is for the state to estimate them, for the state to verify if the needs are not disproportionate to the work. The state will dole out charity. Thence to the English poor law and the workhouse is but a step. There is but a slight difference, because even this stepmother of a society against whom we are in revolt has also been compelled to temper her individualist principles. She, too, has had to make concessions in a communist direction and under the same form of charity. She, too, distributes halfpenny dinners to prevent the pillaging of her shops, builds hospitals, often very bad ones, but sometimes splendid ones, to prevent the ravages of contagious diseases. She, too, after having paid the hours of labour, shelters the children of those she has wrecked. She takes their needs into consideration and doles out charity. Poverty, we have said elsewhere, was the primary cause of wealth. It was poverty that created the first capitalist, because before accumulating surplus value, of which we hear so much, men had to be sufficiently destitute to consent to sell their labour so as not to die of hunger. It was poverty that made capitalists. And if the number of the poor increased so rapidly during the Middle Ages, it was due to the invasions and wars that followed the founding of states, and to the increase of riches resulting from the exploitation of the East. These two causes tore asunder the bonds that kept men together in the agrarian and urban communities, and taught them to proclaim the principle of wages, so dear to the exploiters, instead of the solidarity they formerly practiced in their tribal life. And it is this principle that is to spring from a revolution which men dare to call by the name of social revolution, a name so dear to the starved, the oppressed, and the sufferers. It can never be. For the day on which old institutions will fall under the proletarian axe, voices will cry out, "Bread, shelter, ease for all!" And those voices will be listened to. The people will say, "Let us begin by allaying our thirst for life, for happiness, for liberty, that we have never quenched. And when we shall have tasted of this joy, we will set to work to demolish the last vestiges of middle-class rule. Its morality drawn from account books, its debit and credit philosophy, its mine and yours institutions. In demolishing, we shall build, as Proudhon said, and we shall build in the name of communism and anarchy."